I'm here today to do some creative problem solving about Dunder Mifflin Infinity and field your questions. Dwight.
B.J. Novak was a stand-up comic 4 years out of Harvard when he was recruited for a new TV show, The Office, the American version that launched in 2005. He stayed for 8 seasons, writing, acting, producing, directing. He played the insufferable know-it-all temp, Ryan.
Phyllis.
Did the police solve the problem with the...
Yes, they did. Yes, the social networking feature of the Dunder Mifflin Infinity website was infiltrated by sexual predators.
I don't understand why our website needs to have social networking at all.
Yeah. Novak left before the show's final season a year ago, which gave him some time to finish a book of short fiction. Here he is reading from one of his stories.
The boy kept an even pace with the white dirt-frosted black wheels so he could stare uninterrupted at the creature that he and his mother had captured. Yes, there in the cart, after all these years, was Tony the Tiger, caged at last. And Tony the Tiger promised even more fun ahead. In a bright blast of words spilling from his sportive expression, Tony the Tiger explained that the box on which he was emblazoned contained not just name-brand sugar cereal, as if that weren't enough, but also a miniature treasure chest. And, as if that weren't enough, inside the treasure chest was a secret code. And, as if that weren't enough, the code could possibly lead to a cash prize of $100,000. The bright, isolated kid is who I was in a lot of years, and that comes out, the kid kind of fantasizing about a glossier life, the life of the Kellogg cereal, or why didn't that hare just kick that tortoise's ass? Like, you know, it would have burned me up. I felt like, I think, an overachiever in some ways who was left out of other things. Huh. And I think that came out a lot in the stories.
That is so interesting. And this story in particular and others are kind of Walter Mitty-esque in that very way, but Walter Mitty as a little child.
Yeah, I think, I like the parable nature of some writings of Thurber and some older, I think, earlier writers who wrote comedy with almost more like The Twilight Zone ended up being sort of an entertaining story that was a little more of a parable, had an idea or a twist on a concept at its center. And I like those kinds of stories.
And was that when you started doing these? And by the way, how did you start doing these? Did they just came as germs and you said, oh, I'm going to turn that into a story. Oh, I'm going to do this. And then suddenly you had 67 of them?
Well, yeah, except those germs had been building up for 10 years or so without it ever occurring to me that they could be fiction. I thought of myself as a comedian, a screenwriter.
Right.
So I didn't know what to do with all these ideas that had been rattling around in my head, let alone the emotional things that I'd never expressed in my life that I never thought I'd put anywhere. And then when I just started writing some of these ideas I'd had over the years as stories instead of as the first scene of a TV pilot,
right,
you know, or something Dwight says to Jim,
yeah,
it all kind of came to life.
It's interesting that you said the emotional aspect. Did this feel like you're revealing more of the true B.J. Novak than other work you'd done?
Yeah, and paradoxically too, because I had considered writing. I like writing, and a lot of my contemporaries have written memoirs. And I thought, oh, I could never reveal myself that way. I'm just not a very personal writer. I kind of write ideas. I write concepts. And paradoxically, I think when I turned to fiction, to jam-pack it filled with interesting aspects, I ended up putting lots of very private emotions and details and observations and fantasies and worries. All of myself came into these stories that I thought would obscure the real me. But I think it actually revealed it much more than I would have in a memoir. And if I had written a memoir, I probably would have been consumed with hiding,
yeah,
how I really felt in the service of seeming witty and cool.
Yes.
And this with this book, I went the opposite way.
So fiction tricked you into being earnest and confessional.
Fiction tricked me into being personal.
And when you started saying, okay, this is a form, I'm going to really try this, and I wrote one and then two and then six and 12, at what point in that process did you decide, yeah, there's a book here and I'm going to go to Knopf and they're going to publish it?
How it really developed was after I'd written about 50 pages or so, I'd read them to friends and they would be very charitable and I would revise them based on what I could tell they liked or didn't like, even though they told me they liked everything. Then I booked a spot on a comedy show, actually, at a comedy club and read two of the stories out loud. And when that worked, which was one of the most nerve-wracking nights of my life. I felt so much more exposed reading these pieces of paper than I ever had alone in front of a microphone.
Really?
But when that went well, that became my format for testing the stories, and I did that once a month for a year. Some people came to many shows and commented at the end about how stories had improved or what they missed.
And did that seem like the proper venue form? I guess it did, in which to try something out, because, of course, these are going to be read by individuals in their home and not experienced by a bunch of people in public. Did it feel like that was the apt way to test them?
To me, performing those stories was a process of making sure that I wasn't going to be embarrassed at wasting anyone's time. If I'm standing there alone in the middle of a boring story, I feel awful. I cannot hide behind the authorial instinct to say, well, I'm brilliant and the world doesn't get me.
And I won't have to be there and be embarrassed when they don't like it.
Yes, it's mortifying. And you'll do anything to get to something more entertaining. So often I would do my best editing the hour before I went on stage when I realized, oh, I can't read this. Oh, this isn't ready. Or conversely, oh, this is so great. How do I milk more out of this? What else could happen in this Kellogg story? Channeling that performer ego into being entertaining was the best editorial process I had.
You are also in this an excellent parodist. There's one very funny piece, which is a transcript of a Comedy Central roast of Nelson Mandela. And instead of just working that premise, you have Mandela do a kind of brilliant final comic one-upsmanship of the roasters. It's full of great jokes, but it's more than that.
Well, thank you. I wanted to take I wanted to take the comedian seriously. I didn't want it to just be a bunch of, you know, inappropriate jokes, although that was certainly the central comedic conceit. But I watch these roasts. I like them. And I feel guilty sometimes when I like them. And I know the difference between a Jeff Ross joke and a Sarah Silverman joke. And so I wanted to do justice to the actual comedy content. But I also thought, well, what? How do we go further and deeper than just the sort of cheap contrast between comedy and
Mandela
dignity?
Yes.
Yeah, Mandela. So I thought, well, what would he say? And I thought, well, he's risen above much bigger things than this, much worse human nature than this. How would he rise above? What would he have to teach them? Would he enjoy it on any level? And that was actually ended up being a very fun thing to write.
And again, a good example of it doesn't have to be this binary thing of either it's just joke comedy or, a serious statement about
right.
life today.
Well, that's something I really learned from The Office. There was a real value. It shocked me and annoyed me the first time Steve Carell rejected something that I had written as this sounds like a joke. I was very offended. I was like, yeah, it's a great joke that I worked hard on so you could be funny in your comedy show. And the second or third time he rejected something as sounding like a joke, he came from a very honest school of improvisational comedy where nothing should ever be a joke. All the comedy should be revealed from actual emotion and observation. And when The Office was at its best, I felt we weren't forcing any joke. It was just where the jokes punctuated actual emotion and actual real life was what made them so funny and
right.
so surprising.
You also, in the acknowledgments, thank Mindy Kaling, who's been your close friend and collaborator. You both wrote and produced and acted in The Office, as you've mentioned, and you've worked with her on her show, The Mindy Project. I want to play a clip from The Office in which your characters, Ryan and Kelly, who have this incredibly dysfunctional relationship. And in this scene, she tells a fib in order to get you back together. Mm.
I want you to tell me that you care about me. That is what I want.
Kelly, I'm your boss now, okay? You can't keep talking to me like I'm your boyfriend.
Oh, big, strong man, fancy new whatever. I don't think you ever cared about me.
I never cared about you? 6 months ago, Karen Filippelli sent me an email, asked me out. I said no because I was committed to our relationship.
Well, I hope you're still committed because I'm pregnant. And guess what, buddy? I am keeping it.
Okay.
Do you feel prepared to help me raise a baby?
I can't talk about this right now, okay? After work, we'll go out to dinner. We'll talk about it then, okay?
We have a date.
That's Mindy Kaling and BJ Novak in The Office.
Yeah.
Were there things about her temperament or yours that allowed you to collaborate well?
Well, we collaborated very poorly and in a very fiery manner, not unlike Ryan and Kelly on the show. Creatively, it was very good because we really, really respected each other's notes. We privately gave each other notes on our scripts before we brought them to the rest of the group. And then again, would check in with each other, what do you think of this and that? Even though it wasn't up to us, it was up to Greg Daniels, but we trusted each other very deeply. But in terms of actually working together, no. And we were never given a script to co-write because people thought we would kill each other. And they might have been right. We would often go days without speaking to each other. It was just fiery. It's what became Ryan and Kelly.
Yeah. You're 34 years old.
Yeah.
In the best case professional scenario looking forward, what will you have done by the time you're, say, 44?
I would like to write and make – see, I'd say movies, but you never know. And now I think TV shows matter more to people. I want to write and make entertainment that people say, God, that's my favorite show. And as many of them as possible. I think my fantasy has shifted from being great myself to making great things as I've gotten older. You know who I want to be? I want to be Rod Serling. That's what I want.
Well, I would so wholeheartedly support that. Do you still watch when Sci-Fi runs the old Twilight Zone?
Well, they cut them off a little for syndication. They snip a minute out.
But it's still.
So I watch them on Netflix or DVD.
It's amazing that not anything that extraordinary in that peculiar and particular way they were extraordinary has been done.
So great, so sort of formalistically great.
Yeah.
And such wit without forcing jokes on you, and they last. You know, that type of quality really lasts, and that's that sort of. You know, idea-centered, entertaining parable that yep. I think that's what I want to do. And that's the kind of sort of public author more than movie star that I would dream of being.
May you be so.
Thank you.
BJ Novak, thank you very much.
Kurt, so great to talk to you. Thank you.
BJ Novak's book is called One More Thing, Stories and Other Stories, and it is out right now.